open up your Bibles to the book of Genesis. We're going to look at the story of Noah today. The children's classes, a couple of the children's classes were talking about Noah, and I wanted to do a lesson on him. I think I've talked about this before. I will put together a series of lessons, and no one in the world will know that it's a series. It only works as a series in my own mind, and that's kind of what this one has been lately. Looking at the concept of our relationship with God, how we approach God, what are we when we are with God. And I saw that the children were studying Noah, and I thought, well, that's an interesting character to think about, his connection with God, who he was, what he did. 2 Peter 2, I think verse 5, talks about Noah being a herald or a preacher of righteousness. I think herald is a better translation than the word preacher, because it's not the same word used elsewhere in the New Testament for preach or a preacher. He was a herald of righteousness in his time. And Genesis 6, verse 9 talks about how he was a righteous man, blameless in his generation. Noah walked with God. There are a number of people who walk with God in the Bible. Compared with the numbers of the people that are in the Bible, there aren't that many who walked with God. And then when you take them in the context of everyone who's walked on this planet, there are really not that many people who walked with God. And so there is in Noah's character a lot that we can think about, how he had a connection with God. The lesson is actually not going to be about the flood. I mean, that's the exciting part of the story. It's basically, it's going to end when the rain starts falling, so sorry about that. But there are no good pictures of Noah apart from him in the floating castle. That's what most of the pictures I found of Noah's Ark. There were a whole bunch of them that just looked like giant boxes with cubicles for animals. They were great pictures. I think this one, the person never finished coloring in the animals. Two of them have a little bit of color, and I thought that was interesting. So that's fun. Look up all the pictures of Noah's Ark, and some of them are great. Some of them are great. We're just going to read through the short story of Noah and a little bit of after God starts talking to him. But I'm more interested in the world that was around Noah than building the ark and floating in the water. His story begins in Genesis chapter 5. And Genesis chapter 5, verse 1 is, "This is the book of the generations of Adam." And that shows up a number of different times, the generations of. So it's a storytelling device. Not as in fiction, but we're going to tell this phase. We're going to speak this moment, and we're going to start talking about this person's generations. And so Noah shows up as the generations of Adam, but then you'll notice in chapter 6, verse 9, Noah gets his own the generations of Noah story. That doesn't mean it's a different set of generations. I mean, if Noah's great-great-great-great-grandfather is Adam, well, then the generations of Noah are also in line with Adam. But it is a way that Moses, when he's writing the book of Genesis, it's like, here's a new beginning, and here's a new beginning, and here we're going to start this phase. So I think that's helpful to see. So in the generations of Adam, starting in chapter 5, verse 29, when Lamech had lived 182 years, he fathered a son and called his name Noah, saying, "Out of the ground that the Lord has cursed, this one shall bring us relief from our work and from the painful toil of our hands." Lamech lived after he fathered Noah 595 years and had other sons and daughters. Thus all the days of Lamech were 777 years, and he died. After Noah was 500 years old, Noah fathered Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And so that's the stories of Adam's generations, right? That's how it's told. Someone is born, he has sons, and he dies, and then we get Noah. Noah, after he was a certain amount of years old, he had three sons. And now the story changes. And you've got a chapter break there, but imagine there's no chapter break. This whole moment, generations of Adam, he had sons, he grew up, and he died. had sons, he grew, and he died, and he died, and he died. When we get to Enoch, and he was not. There's no died. And that's the interesting storytelling and the conviction that we're supposed to get out of chapter 5. But as it moves on, Noah was 500 years old. Noah fathered Shem, Ham, and Japheth. When man began to multiply on the face of the land and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of man were attractive, and they took their wives as they chose. It's just changed. It's left the individuals, and now it's talking about the world. Noah is named for relief. This is the one who will bring us relief from the work of the painful toil of our hands. The ground was cursed. And Lamech has this prophecy that Noah is going to be the one who's going to bring relief. And that relief is coming for a cursed ground, but everything above the ground is cursed too, right? Look at chapter 6, verse 1. When man began to multiply on the face of the land, and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of man were attractive, and they took as their wives any they chose. And the Lord said, "My spirit shall not abide in man forever. For he is flesh. His days shall be 120 years. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, or the giants. And also afterward, when the sons of God came into the daughters of man, and they bore children to them, these were the mighty men who were of old, the men of renown. The Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intention of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord regretted that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him into his heart. So the Lord said, I will blot out man whom I have created from the face of the land, man and animals and creeping things and birds of the heavens, for I am sorry that I have made them. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. These are the generations of Noah. It's a really interesting way. Take those big chapter breaks out and see how that story is being told. We zoom out and we get a picture of what are these generations living in. And the ground is cursed. And Lamech is seeing Noah is the one who's going to bring about relief from this curse. And we zoom out and we realize it ain't just the ground that's cursed. Everyone is living a cursed life. And in this moment, the word everyone means everyone. Well, we do have verse 8, but Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. You take Noah and his family out, and it's everyone. So this is a really rough situation. He's named for the relief from this curse, but mankind is growing worse and worse and worse. We have vain selfishness in this people. Now, it talks about how the sons of God are seeing the daughters of man. And there's a lot of excitement and joy in trying to figure out who they are and what this Nephilim is. And I tend to go with what is a very simple understanding of the Bible. I find that simple is probably the more accurate interpretation. I think the idea here is in all of chapter 5, we've had the generations of Adam. And who were the generations before that? In chapter 4, we had Cain and his generations. And they go a certain way. But in chapter 5, these are the ones who are calling on God, or they are looking to God. And we have these generations of people that seem to be good. And I think that that's the idea here. Eventually, the sons of God, the ones who are trying to be good, they see that the daughters of man are attractive, and they start taking anyone they want as a wife. Now, it's not just they started getting married. I think it's interesting how it said they were taking. They were taking anyone they chose. And that's not really a nice way of describing marriage. This is more taking rather than uniting. Already in Genesis, we've seen the importance of the two becoming one flesh, and they're going to leave their father and mother behind. They're going to unite and become one. And here in chapter 6, we have the ones who are of God, who are just taking whom they want. Now, the result is they have great kids, massive kids, men of renown, the Nephilim. And there's this wonderful thing. But who cares if there are giants walking the earth and everyone's awful? That means they're just giant, awful. And so the people, it seems, anyone who had any connection with God is leaving that behind. They're taking whom they want, and they're saying, look at how great my kids are. Look at how powerful we are. Look, we are men and people of renown. And it just really doesn't matter that much at all. Because when God looks down in verse 5, he just sees that their wickedness is great, not that they're tall. This is where I insert a joke about it's okay to be short, maybe better to be a short. So that's what God is seeing in all these people making these great things for themselves, and they're doing these wonderful things. I've been reading Psalm 106 recently. There's a statement how the people were wandering in the wilderness and they were complaining and wanting all these things from God. And in verse 15, he gave them their request but sent leanness to their soul. The people are wanting and they're taking whom they want and they're making these great, wonderful kids, but their souls are diseased and their lives are getting farther and farther from God. And so what we have here in verses 5 through 8 is this unbearable wickedness. The wickedness is so great that it is unbearable. Now, quite honestly, is any wickedness bearable? I mean, all of it should always be wrong, but God is looking down and seeing that every intention of their heart was evil continually. What can you do with a heart that's like that? God's reaction is, well, we're just going to wash it off, wash it away. We see that there is wickedness that is bringing destruction to other people. Humans are wicked, and all the animals are going to die. Wait, that makes no sense. I am wicked, and my family is going to suffer, and my friends are going to suffer, and you are going to suffer. Why? Because that's what evil does. And that's what this story is painting us. Individuals are becoming wicked, so much so that everyone is becoming wicked, and now everything needs to be destroyed because of this wickedness. And we have God regretting and God having sorrow. Have you thought about those words being connected to God and how significant that is? Look at verse 6. The Lord regretted that he had made man. I don't understand how an all-knowing and all-powerful God can regret something later on that he did earlier when he knew all the things. This is a complicated idea, but God can look with what he has made and feel regret. How much do you have to do? What do you have to do to make God regret you? Now, don't think, okay, well, maybe I got a lot of room. I got a lot of room to be evil before that starts happening. No, the reality here is that God can look down and see what we're doing and feel regret for who and what we are and what we're making of this place. And he can feel sorrow because of that. This is a big deal. We affect God in this paragraph, not for any good. We don't make God. We don't change God. But when we are wicked, it affects God. And that's sad and that's scary. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. This word favor means grace. It can refer to charm and elegance. When God looked down at Noah, I don't know if that meant he was walking gracefully. But in comparison with everyone around him, his footsteps were graceful. His footsteps were favorable. And so then we have the generations of Noah. Verse 9. Noah was a righteous man, blameless in his generation. Noah walked with God, and Noah had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Now the earth was corrupt in God's sight, and the earth was filled with violence. God saw the earth, and behold, it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. And God said to Noah, I have determined to make an end of all flesh, for the earth is filled with violence through them. Behold, I will destroy them with the earth. Make for yourself an ark of gopher wood. Make rooms in the ark and cover it inside and out with pitch. This is how you were to make it. Its length shall be of the ark 300 cubits, its breadth 50 cubits, and its height 30 cubits. Make a roof for the ark and finish it to a cubit above and set the door in the ark and its side. Make it with lower, second, and third decks. For behold, I will bring a flood of waters upon the earth to destroy all flesh in which is the breath of life under heaven. Everything that is on the earth shall die, but I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall come into the ark, you and your sons and your wife and your sons' wives with you. And every living thing of all flesh you shall bring two of every sort into the ark to keep them alive with you. They shall be male and female. In verse 22, Noah did this. And so God has destruction and covenant. He has set up for the world, which is breaking all of his rules, destruction. And for this one who is walking with God, walking righteously and set apart blamelessly, Noah sets God sets up a covenant or a promise with him. In 1 John chapter 2, verse 15, do not love the world or the things of the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. The things of this earth are going to go away, and our connection with God is the only thing that has any lasting, anything that we can set our hope in. And so these are just the events that I want to talk about as this story of Noah. There are those around him who are taking rather than uniting in marriage. There are those who seem to be vain in what their aims and their goals are. And then we have this one who was walking with God righteously and blamelessly. It's a pretty simple story, simple set of ideas. The ark is a complicated idea to think about, but just think about this. Jesus talked about Noah and the ark. Jesus believed that the story of Noah and the ark was a true account of Noah and the ark. So that's something that we can believe in, even if the story seems odd to us. Jesus, who died for us and was raised from the dead by his own power, tells the story of Noah and the ark. This is a story we can believe in. A lot of people in the world might not think it's believable, and I might think it's a challenging story to believe in. Jesus believed in it, and so I do too. That's a separate idea, but I think it's something to think about. I want to talk a little bit here about, I have to invent this, but can you imagine the relationship that Noah had with his dad, Lamech? I mean, they got to hang out for 595 years. I don't know if they were around each other every day. There's going to be relationship there. And I don't know how old Noah was before Lamech said, you know what your name means? You are bringing relief. So I have this picture in my mind of little Noah going, oh my stars, I'm going to do what? And I don't know what that sort of expectation would be. What was their expectation? I don't think Lamech just made it up. I would imagine, as it's recorded in Scripture, that this is a prophecy given him by God, and that's where this naming comes into. And I imagine it could have been difficult for Moses. Oh, man, I keep mixing up Moses and Noah every time I tell any story. It might have been difficult for Noah living with those sorts of expectations and Lamech kind of going, well, have you done it yet? I don't know what that's going to be like. But these are sort of situations in the sticky encounters that we find ourselves in, these expectations that we have in life. There's a quote from a book it was about a mother who was dealing with the complications of watching her children grow up. She had this statement, but maybe you must learn, and it's hard learning, she's from Kentucky, it's hard learning, not to hope out loud, especially for other people. You must not let your hope turn into expectation. And that really has stuck with me. Lamech, who has this prophecy about his son, it's not about Lamech making this happen. And quite honestly, if Noah's going to bring about a relief to the curse, do you think Noah's the one who's going to do it? Right? Noah isn't going to say, all right, today's the day. I'm going to fix the globe, the curse that God gave. This is all the work of God. And so we have these tasks set before us. Or we set tasks before others that are literally the work of God. And trying to fulfill those expectations are going to be hard sometimes, are going to be intimidating sometimes. And they're also not going to show up the way that we expect them to. Do you think that after 600 years, because that's when the waters start coming down, or I can't remember if that's when God starts speaking to Noah, but basically, do you think that after 600 years of thinking about how is this relief going to happen, do you think that the answer was coming into his mind, I know, God's going to destroy the globe and start over again with me and a bunch of animals that float around in a box? I don't think this is what Noah had in mind. Because this is a terrible thing to think about. Yes, God is saving Noah. Who and what is God not saving? This is scary. This is intense. And whatever Noah's expectations were, I don't think this was it. And we have work set before us, and we have expectations about how it's going to go or what it's going to look like, whether it's in our family, whether it's with teaching, whether it's working in the community, whether it's teaching someone that we know and we're trying to convert somebody, and it's not going to go the way we see or imagine or expect every time. And that's awful. That's hard. In Isaiah chapter 10, we have this prophecy about the remnant. In that day, the remnant of Israel and the survivors of the house of Jacob will no more lean on him who struck them, but they will lean on the Lord, the Holy One of Israel, in truth. A remnant will return, the remnant of Jacob, to the mighty God. In order for a remnant to return, 95% of the garment is destroyed. And that's scary. And that's hard. And so as we're interacting and as we're doing what we need to do, and we have expectations of saving this whole garment that God has given us, Isaiah is letting us know only a remnant is going to return. Sometimes we take the time and say, thank God that a remnant will survive. You will always have your people. We will always be connected with you. And sometimes we take a step back and we realize, this is scary, and this is hard. And when we walk with God, we're going to go in places that we might not expect, or we might not want, things that are going to feel hard. Read through Habakkuk chapter 1 sometime. The story of Habakkuk chapter 1 is Habakkuk saying in the first two or three verses, 2 through 4, God, evil everywhere. When are you going to fix this? And God says in verses 5 through 11, in Daniel's paraphrase, you know, you're right. How about I bring in an army full of atomic bombs and we'll just destroy all this stuff? At which point, Habakkuk goes, whoa. No, the Chaldeans are bad. They're bad. I mean, I know we're sinning, but they're bad. God. And you see, this is not what he was expecting and not what he was wanting, but it was what was coming. And that's a hard lesson sometimes. And I don't know what it's going to look like. I'm not a prophet. But I know how it has looked for other people, and we need to be ready for these sorts of thoughts. And then we think about Noah, who was a herald of righteousness. He was this preacher of righteousness. 7 others saved, right? That's that description in 2 Peter 2, verse 5. Yeah, I guess you can read that up there. Sometimes we ask, how successful is the preacher? How successful is the work? How much is the church growing? And when we ask these questions, we are asking numbers because that's how we operate and how we think. You know, how are the apples doing? There's a lot of apples. Okay, they're doing really well, all right? But when we ask this sort of question about preaching and how successful it is, we need to think about it in another way. One way of thinking about this is the activity of the preaching happening? And if the activity of the preaching is happening, then there is success. Noah was a herald of righteousness. He was a preacher of righteousness in that he preached. And that's success. If you count the numbers of the people who got in the boat versus the people who did not get in the boat, it doesn't sound like success. But the fact that he was a preacher of righteousness, especially in that generation, that's success. And that's something that we need to bear in mind. Sometimes when we start counting up the numbers and counting up the fruit, we only count half the fruit. We only count half the fruit because we like to count the fruit that's good. Here is the good result. Here is the good fruit. These are the nice things that we wanted. But the real truth is Jesus was successful not just because 12 guys stuck with him at the end of John chapter 6. Jesus was successful when he preached in John chapter 6 and people decided to leave him. Bad fruit is still the fruit of the preaching. And that's hard. So how do you think that herald felt when the rain started falling? I don't know. There could have been that good riddance to bad rubbish. Wash it away, God. And you know, that is a sentiment in the scriptures. Dear God, wash away the wickedness. But I also get the sense that he might have had the same sort of feeling that Paul had in Romans chapter 9, verse 3, for I could wish that I myself were cursed and cut off from them for Christ, cut off from Christ for the sake of my brothers, my kinsmen according to the flesh. Paul was just wishing that his brothers, the Jewish people who were not listening to Christ, that they would come. He was willing to lose himself in order to bring them about and bring them to God. So these are hard things. We live in a hard world. His wife, his three sons, and his three daughters-in-law got on the boat with him. But none of his uncles and none of his aunts and none of his cousins and none of his nieces and none of his nephews. His dad did not get in the boat, but his dad passed away before this event happened. Go up and do the math on the other old guys before him, and I don't know, you might find somebody who looks like he died in the flood and not died of old age. These are sad stories. These are sad ideas. We get to that question, why bother at all? If no one's going to listen and if all the fruit is bad, in Matthew chapter 3, verse 15, Jesus answers the question, me baptize you, you ought to be baptizing me. Why does Jesus need to be baptized? And every time I read through this story and read through that, I myself wonder, why does Jesus need to be baptized? His answer is, let it be so now, for thus it is fitting for us to fulfill all righteousness. I like that answer. I don't always know what that means. But why should Noah bother preaching if no one else is going to get in the boat? Because it fulfills all righteousness. That's how we walk blamelessly. In fact, if we're walking blamelessly, we are preaching. If we are righteous and walking with God, we are preaching and we are fulfilling all righteousness. And then we have this wonderful moment that Peter tells us about in chapter 3, verse 1. Likewise, wives, be subject to your own husbands, so that even if some do not obey the word, they may be won without a word by the conduct of their wives. Even if they don't listen to the message that we speak, they can listen to the words of our actions. And so we need to walk with God and proclaim this. We're going to stand alone, and it's going to feel really sad. Not every day, but a lot of it in February, I have found, because February is February. You're going to feel sad, and you're going to feel alone, and you're going to feel cold. Again, I've got February on the mind. And these things are going to be hard, and they might not listen to our words, but we're going to live the right way anyways. And Noah didn't save his kids and his wife. God did. But Noah helped them out by walking with God. And our experiences around us are going to be sad and they're going to be hard. But they're not going to change what we say. Maybe our experiences will change our tone. Maybe our attitude. Maybe the way that we approach somebody might change. But are we ever going to change the message? The preaching doesn't change. Maybe the manner of the preaching changes, but the preaching doesn't change. And that's something that we need to think about. We stand alone, walking with God, trying to be blameless, trying to be righteous, just like Noah. You're not going to do that with any pride and any selfishness. We're going to do it selflessly. And then we learn a lot about God in this story. We learn a lot about God. I like this picture. That's a preacher. He's got his arms up. This is why I wave my arms. God has things die. We don't always like that message. He drowned a world. He let his son get murdered and hang on a cross. And he wants our own old lives to die, be buried in the waters of baptism, and that we walk anew. He does not want us to let that old person live. He wants it dead. That's hard. And the message that Noah was sharing and the reality that Noah lived through was a hard reality. But God teaches us again and again, things are going to die in order for there to be life. And God's fulfillment, it's not going to look like what we expect it to be. Or God's success isn't necessarily what we think is going to be success. And if something needs to die, it's not what I'm expecting, and I'm going to be sad, but I'm going to be connected to God. And if we're preaching and people don't hear the way we want them to, well, God speaks about success in another way. There's a story, the parable of the rich man and Lazarus. And the rich man says, send Lazarus back from the dead. They'd listen to him. And the Lord says, they have Moses and the prophets. If you don't listen to Moses and the prophets, if you don't listen to the words written down that Jesus spoke and that his apostles wrote about Jesus, then some guy walking around back from the dead is not going to make any difference to you. And so the reality is, it is they who need to listen, not what can I possibly do to make them change. But people need to listen. So that should be a relief taken off of our shoulders. We need to live right and share what we can. And I really believe this. I don't know if there's a whole lot of Bible verses that back this up and say that this is an absolute truth, but I believe this. I'm sure Noah felt alone. And I don't know if Mrs. Noah, well, like, I'm here. Why do you feel alone? Like, well, you know, seven people in a boat, you're going to feel alone. Crowded, but alone. But I don't think God sees us as alone. When Jesus says, where two or more of you are gathered together, there I am among them. This isn't secret code on how to get a church anywhere you want. This is, you are not alone. God is with us. God is with us. And when we are together, we are not alone. And if there's only seven of us in this room, we're going to feel alone when there's only seven of us in a room. But we're not alone. We're with God. I've been to churches number of times in my life where my family was the whole gathering. And that's not that exciting. It's intimidating and it's lonely. And you wonder, are we even doing the right thing? And God is letting us know that we are. Well, make sure you are, okay? Don't just assume you're fine. But if we're obeying God's word and we happen to find ourselves numerically alone, we're not alone. And that's something that we need to get into our hearts and get into our minds, that God is with us. And when the world is not with us, we shouldn't be surprised, because the world is not with God. And we need to get away from the world and we need to get with God. Look at Psalm 32. We'll read Psalm 32 and we'll close with this message. I'm really impressed with what Noah was able to do and the way that Noah was able to walk with God in circumstances that I assume would have been pretty depressing, putting myself in his shoes. I would have felt pretty depressed, pretty sad, felt like this is hard. And he did the right thing. And that's what we need to do as well. Look at Psalm 32 and look for the moment of a flood. I don't think this is about the flood, but you can hear it. Blessed is he whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered. Blessed is the man unto whom the Lord imputes not iniquity, and in whose spirit there is no guile. When I kept silence, my bones waxed old through my roaring all the day long. For day and night thy hand was heavy upon me. My moisture was changed as with the drought of summer. I acknowledged my sin unto thee, and my iniquity have I not hid. And I said, I will confess my transgressions unto the Lord, and thou forgavest the iniquity of my sin. For this, let everyone that is godly pray unto thee at a time when thou mayest be found. Surely when the great waters overflow, they shall not reach unto him. Thou art my hiding place. Thou wilt preserve me from trouble. Thou wilt compass me about with songs of deliverance. I will instruct thee and teach thee in the way in which thou shalt go. I shall counsel thee with mine eye upon thee. Be ye not as the horse or as the mule, which have no understanding, whose trappings must be bit and bridle to hold them in, else they will not come near unto thee. Many sorrows shall be to the wicked, But he that trusts in the Lord, mercy shall compass him about. Be glad in the Lord and rejoice, you righteous, and shout for joy, all ye that are upright in heart. God promises to take care of us. The confession and the speaking in that psalm was about our own sin. But you can transfer that into speaking the truth about God to others around us. And when we are with God, the waters aren't going to reach high enough to drown us. We're going to be okay. And so we need to reach out to God at a time when he may be heard. And he will be heard today. If you pray to God today, this is a time where he will listen to you. The point is, I don't know if you're going to have time to do it tomorrow. We don't know what sort of time we have. These are the times when we can reach out to God for strength and for forgiveness. And so if there's anyone here who needs prayers with that, help with that, we want to help you. We want to help you have a connection with God. Why don't you come forward as we stand together and sing?